I want to tell you about a new investigative podcast called She Has a Name. It's about a young mother who disappeared in Detroit in the summer of 1987. She Has a Name tells the story of loss and redemption, mending broken family ties, and facing the trauma experienced by countless individuals who've lost loved ones to violence. Join host Tanya Mosley and her nephew Antonio as they unravel the secrets of what happened to Anita Wiley. You can search for She Has a Name in your podcast app. Welcome to WDET's special live coverage of the Mackinac Policy Conference, live from the dining room of the Grand Hotel on Mackinac Island. This is our annual trip north for politicians, business leaders, members of the philanthropic community, and the media to discuss Michigan's problems together, away from home, to see if maybe the sunshine, the horses, the fudge, the taffy inspire us to come up with different ideas, different solutions than we would back home. Today, we are going to have 2 hours of coverage from 9 to 10 a.m. and then again from 11 to noon. And we've got a lot on tap. We will hear from Governor Gretchen Whitmer. We will talk with Rip Rapson, the CEO of the Kresge Foundation, about the foundation's 100th anniversary and much more. But we are going to begin today with Representative Alyssa Slotkin, a member of Congress, who has also announced that she will be a candidate for the open Senate seat here in the state of Michigan. Alyssa, great to see you up here.
Thanks for having me. What a great place to be, quote unquote, in studio.
Yeah, that's right. It's been a while since we've seen each other in person.
It has.
I ask everyone this question first. What's your agenda this week? What are your goals? What kind of things do you hope to get done up here?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I just think it's amazing. This conference, I think, is unique in the United States. I can't, when I explain it to my fellow members of Congress,
they have no idea.
They're like, what?
Right.
I mean, I'm like, we all come to an island, Democrats, Republicans, unions, business leaders, environmental folks, energy folks, and we get on an island where it's hard to kind of get off. There's no cars and it's small, so we see each other everywhere.
Yeah.
And I think it's pretty unusual, especially now, given how polarized we are. So I like coming up here for that reason. My agenda is, I think, what a lot of people's is. You can see so many people in the span of 2 or 3 days in a way, you know, from across the state that would take me months to go and see these folks in person. So it's good networking, quote unquote. But I think for me, you know, we dropped a big piece of legislation yesterday, and the Secretary of Commerce is coming to speak, Gina Raimondo, today, and we worked hand in glove with her team on basically giving her the authority to block things like Chinese vehicles from coming into the United States before they get here, because I'm watching what's going on in Europe and in Mexico, and they are just eating up market share, super cheap, subsidized $10,000 vehicles where all the video and all the radar goes back to China. So I've been kind of stuck on this issue given my national security background, but also being a Michigander.
Yeah, it's an interesting issue where commerce and intelligence overlap.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not sure a lot of people in Michigan are familiar with this Chinese vehicle issue. We don't have that happening here.
We don't, which is why I'm obsessed about it, because the minute, so just to give you a perspective, the first Chinese electric vehicle was sold in Europe, in the European Union, in 2021, and they now have 25% of market share, because they make it super cheap, so it undersells, and they kind of made it look nicer. It's not like, doesn't look like the early versions that they made. It kind of looks like a Tesla, right? And so, and then now they have almost 30% of market share in Mexico. And the Chinese government and the Chinese companies, are looking at factories in Mexico, right? So why would you be looking at factories in Mexico if your plan wasn't to come and start providing those vehicles in the United States? And right now, there's no legal authority for anyone to say, well, this is a commercial product that is a threat to national security, so we're going to ban it. Yeah. We don't have that. You can throw tariffs on something. That's a step. But there's no way to have a national security review of anything, of a part, piece of LIDAR, that even in an American vehicle, right, that's imported from China. So that's my focus, is to say sometimes a piece of commercial, a commercial item can pose a bigger threat. You know, can you imagine the Chinese government having video and LIDAR of every military base, every infrastructure site, and knowing, geolocating where specific leaders are in these cars? No. I don't like that. Yeah. So anyways, it's just become kind of my obsession, and we use the conference as a way to announce that, and the Secretary of Commerce coming helps kind of seal it.
Yeah. I mean, that's a wonderful concrete example of the kind of things that people try to do up here. We're not just loafing around riding in carriages.
Yes.
We do a little of that.
Yes. there's definitely some people pre-gaming here. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely, I'm not going to lie, but that I've seen that. But
a lot of work.
You can get a lot of work done. It's having everyone in the same space is a positive thing.
Yeah. I want to ask you about something that is not happening here on Mackinac tonight. We are supposed to see you and Mike Rogers and Justin Amash and the other hopefuls for the U.S. Senate seat on stage debating the issues. We're not going to get to do that.
Yeah.
Tell us why.
So I signed up for this debate in April and actually had my debate binder, and we had mock debates going on and practices and the whole thing. It was sold to me as it's been every year, three Democrats, three Republicans. The chamber likes to do that. They did it, I think, in 2018.
Yep.
So I was on board, and we were preparing, but Mr. Rogers and Mr. Amash refused to participate. So the chamber came back to us and they said, well, let's just do three Democrats, one Republican. I said, hey, man, let's make it 2-on-2. Let's keep it balanced. Right. That was the proposal. And we couldn't get there. But, I've done 10 debates in the past 6 years, both primary and general. I consider it, a strength.
Yeah.
And so we're open and happy and plan to debate both for primary and general.
Yeah. So here's an idea. I think the candidates have too much control over this.
Okay.
I think we should have an independent commission that regulates the number of debates and where they're going to be and when they're going to be, and the candidates just show up. I mean, I've seen too often us not get the opportunity to see people talking in front of the voters about the issues. And I think it just doesn't work. My prediction is that we won't get a debate from the Senate candidates this year. Because
not if I have anything to say about it.
You want to have a debate.
I've reached out to the Harper campaign once this chamber one fell apart.
Yeah.
Literally, I've always done live, often televised debates.
No, you've done it a lot.
And I've committed to that. I do public town halls constantly in my congressional life. I think in its best moments, showing voters the differences without being nasty and just debating, that's like the heart of democracy. So I believe in it. I'm not only am I open to it, I'm the only one who's done it as much. I mean, of all the candidates, no one's done more debates than I have in both primary and in general.
Yeah. Would it be easier for you if there were just, a schedule of debates each year that were decided and agreed upon by members of the media, by maybe the parties, and all you had to do was show up?
I think Oakland University is trying
do
something. Maybe you're part of that. I'm sorry.
They're trying. They don't have all of the media buy-in yet, at least. So I think that gives them a little bit of a disadvantage.
Yeah, but I would say that if there's an organization to it, it might be useful, because we've been pitched by every, Fox and this and that and every outlet. Yeah. Obviously, I think, to me, you just have to have reasonable rules of the road, right? You just have to have a policy, and they have to be run by people who are neutral, right? Which is, I think, and we've had people come and pitch us on debates where it's like, you've already endorsed one of the candidates. It's not really a debate if you're skewing something. Yeah. So there has to be rules, but we've always had multiple debates in every single race that I've run. So it's not been a problem for me.
Yeah. Okay. I want to spend the last couple of minutes talking about what Washington's like, and the chamber you are elected to in Washington. which does not seem to be able to govern itself these days. The majority can't even decide week to week whether they want the speaker to have their job. Just give us a sense of how that works, what that's like with that level of chaos.
Yeah, I mean, basically, there's such a small majority, right? The Republicans have control, but by so few seats that the infighting among them, frankly, dominates most weeks. You know, there'll be a bill that comes up from one of their committees, but it can't get to the floor of the House because a faction of the Republicans, the Freedom Caucus, doesn't like it. So there's a lot of waiting around, if you're a Democrat right now, for the Republicans to work out their problems. We wait for smoke signals out of their meetings, which get from, you know, pretty rowdy from what I've heard. And then when something does get to the floor, it's just, it's like ridiculous, some of these bills, right? It's taking this person's salary down to $1. It's getting rid of every diversity program at the Department of Agriculture or whatever. In the meantime, when we're not doing a lot of substantive work on real issues, bad behavior is at a premium, right? So watching people play to the crowds, to the media, the Marjorie Taylor Greens and Lauren Boberts and people getting into fights that you would never want elementary school kids to ever see. It's just people have stopped legislating in many ways, and they're just there to be Twitter stars. And it doesn't, you know, as someone with a national security background, it just rankles me to see the lack of leadership, frankly. Personal leadership.
Okay, Alyssa Slotkin, it's always great to talk with you.
Thank you.
Always
Thanks
great to see
me.
You here on Mackinac Island. Thanks for coming by.
Good to see you. Have a good rest of the conference.
Yes. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue our live coverage from the dining room of the Grand Hotel on Mackinac Island, the Mackinac Policy Conference. Dan Kildee, another member of Congress, is up next. A little later, we're going to hear from Gretchen Whitmer, who is the governor of the state of Michigan as well. Stay where you are. We'll be right back with more from Mackinac Island.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
Welcome back to WDET's live coverage of the Mackinac Policy Conference from the dining room of the Grand Hotel on Mackinac Island. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm joined now by another member of our congressional delegation here in the state of Michigan, Dan Kildee, who is in his last few months, in fact, of being a member of Congress. Dan, always great to see you.
It's good to see you, Stephen.
Yes. The reason I wanted to have this conversation with you is because you are leaving. You're just walking away.
End of the year.
Yeah.
No, this was not a surprise to the folks that are close to me, because when I ran 12 years ago, my wife and I had a very explicit conversation that this is something we'll do for a season.
Yeah.
You know, and we thought about
season in life.
Season in life. 10 or 12 years, and as it turns out, it'll be 12 when I'm done. I never had it in my head to work the rest of my productive work life as a member of Congress. It's okay for some people to do that.
Yeah.
But it's a pretty unnatural existence, at least in terms of the way I'm wired.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it's unnatural to, first of all, live in two different places that are 600 miles and a million miles apart.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just two completely different
environments. Flint and Washington, D.C.
Yeah. But it's also unnatural because a lot of folks in my business wouldn't acknowledge this, or maybe don't even believe it.
Mm-hmm.
None of us are wired for the kind of stuff we have to deal with.
And
a lot of people assume that because we chose this work, that we must have some sort of, you know, genetic malformation that allows us to, like, take all sorts of incoming, some
abuse,
of the nastiest stuff. And the truth of the matter is, you know, we're not wired for this. it is hard.
Yeah.
It can be painful. It can be difficult. And then, you know, you have certain moments that go way beyond the pale. We talked about January 6th before.
Sure, yeah.
So when I say that, that's what I mean by it's not a natural environment.
Yeah, it's difficult.
And I don't think you want people in those jobs that become so numb that they don't feel that. Because that's dangerous, too.
Yeah. What kinds of things are you working on in the last few months to make sure that you complete some things or set some things up that will endure after you're gone?
Yeah, I think most of it is to make sure that the pieces that we've put in place have some degree of permanence.
Yeah.
One example, what we're working on right now, is making sure that the Flint Registry, which is the process by which people in Flint access resources as a part of the recovery from the water crisis.
Yeah.
It's run by Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha.
Yes.
We want to make sure that has long-term permanent funding, and we're working to get that in. I'll be straight. This is not a Congress that is going to be predisposed to a lot of new groundbreaking initiatives. So much of the work is really about the budget process and making sure that the priorities that I care about receive the help, the support that I think is necessary.
Yeah, yeah.
There are a few things I would like to see. If there's a package toward the end of the year that has some space for some policy work, I'd like to see a bill that I wrote that is intended to help communities that are negatively affected by globalization and trade to develop plans for redevelopment, incentivize redevelopment in the most distressed places. It's called Trade Adjustment Assistance for Communities, a term that doesn't really describe what it is, but because it had to fit a certain bucket. So, I mean, it kind of connects, I guess, to the work that I've been doing, you know, in lots of different roles for a long time.
Yeah. Flint, the water crisis there is still, I think, front of mind for people in that community. It's way more back of mind or out of mind for many other people. Even people in our own state, I think, have moved on. How satisfied are you that we've got the things in place that we need in place for the people of Flint to recover from that? And what's the work maybe that's still ahead?
Well, I would say I'm unsatisfied in the sense that there's still more that Flint needs. You know, the long-term effect of the water crisis goes well beyond the need to fix the pipes and deliver drinkable water. Something as fundamental as rebuilding trust in government will take a lot longer than it took for that trust to be lost.
Yes.
And that's important for a community like Flint to be able to trust institutions, because it's a community that's made up of folks who are quite dependent on functional institutions of government, and they can't rely on that right now. But I think the work that needs to continue is really about fixing the economic and social impact of the water crisis.
Yeah.
We got a lot of money to fix the pipes. What we haven't been able to do yet is figure out how to sort of put things back together.
Mm-hmm.
The city lost 20,000 people in the few years of the Flint water crisis.
Wow.
20% of its population, the people who could relocate, leaving behind a more difficult city to manage. And what I worry about is, you made this point, that there is sort of a Flint fatigue that some people have.
Forgetting, right?
And, you know, my view on that is, no, I'm not going to let that happen. I'm not going to let people just get away with that, whether it's my colleagues in Washington or even people around the state. Look, this is you broke it, you bought it.
Yeah.
but the other point, and I don't need to belabor this, the other point, I'm not satisfied because the underlying conditions that allowed a Flint, Michigan to occur are still very much in place. It's the result of a municipal finance system that does not recognize the realities of the 21st century.
Absolutely.
And we got to fix that. We can't let Flint just get back to the point it was at before the water crisis. That wasn't a good place.
Right.
Even if we got it back there, that's not a good place to be. One mistake away from going into freefall. We need a new social contract. that says that there are certain elements of civil society that are guaranteed to every person living in the wealthiest country on the face of the planet at the wealthiest moment in its history. Yeah. And if we can't deliver that, we're going to have more Flint, Michigans. It might not be about water. It's going to be about something.
I remember when the water crisis happened, one of the things I wrote was that Flint had been a victim of public policy for decades,
yes.
Right? It was a victim of a bad decision that poisoned the water for a short period of time.
Right.
But for decades before that, public policy had failed the city.
No question.
And not just Flint, as you point out. Every city in the state of Michigan is a victim of a municipal finance system that's insane.
Yeah.
It just is never going to provide enough.
Yeah. And the only difference that it's a big difference, but the difference that Flint faces is that it had its crisis in full view of the country
yes.
and the world.
Yes.
Whereas most communities that are struggling with the same sort of preconditions, there's no fanfare. There's no excitement or interest.
Yeah.
There's no celebrities parachuting in for a photo op
right.
and then leaving, which
yeah.
is what happened in Flint.
Yes, yes.
There's no attention to it. And so it's treated as if the people living in the communities that we just described are the cause of their circumstance.
Absolutely.
And they are the victims of the circumstances that they're in. And it is policies over the years.
Yep.
That have allowed wealth and economic activity to relocate out of those, you know, core communities into the region as if it's happening as a natural function of the marketplace
right.
when it's not.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a result of policy.
So you will come back to Flint after December 31st this year when
Coming
you're no
home.
Longer a member of Congress. What are you going to do?
Well, I have accepted the offer to become the president of the Community Foundation of Greater Flint.
Ah, I don't think I knew this.
It's an organization that is almost entirely focused on
yeah.
the subject that you and I were just
yes,
addressing.
Yes, absolutely.
And you know, there are some resources there. There are partners, like the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, mm-hmm. for example, that I'll be able to work with. And without having to go through the legislative process in Washington,
right.
I'll be able to, on a smaller scale,
yeah.
do the work that I think is, you know, similar to the work that I've been doing for the last 30 years.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever changed jobs. I just get a different business card, and that's kind of what's going on. And I won't have to fly to work.
Right,
That's another good thing.
Well, I have such a vivid memory of the first time you and I met. I came to Flint so you could show me what you were doing with the land bank
yeah.
there. But then you said, look, we got to get in the car. And you drove me all over the place, showing me all kinds of things in Flint. I just remember the energy and the gleam you had just driving around the city, the city that is your home and has been.
It's, you know, Flint's one of the loves of my life.
Yeah.
And I know it's a tough place. And I know we have a lot of problems, but everything I have, everything I've been given, came from Flint, Michigan,
yeah.
and I love the place. And it's got good bones. We can make it better.
Yeah, yeah. I'm gonna ask you this. I don't expect you to necessarily answer. What about the seat that you're vacating? What's gonna happen with that?
Well, I mean, there's a robust primary on both sides of the
I mean, it's one of the most watched districts in the country.
It is.
Really.
It
is.
It's
going to be a very tight race, I think.
Yeah, it will be. And, you know, we showed, I think, in the last election that the approach that I tend to take, which is roll up our sleeves, solve the problems. I'm not, you know, a bomb thrower. I'm not going to be I'm not going to go viral in a committee hearing calling somebody a name.
Yeah.
I just like to get the work done. That approach is rewarded. It's a 1-point Republican-leaning district that I won by over 10 points
yeah.
in 2022
yeah.
against a really well-funded opponent.
Absolutely.
And he may well be the Republican nominee again. So I'm confident that with the right campaign, a Democrat can win. My goal is that we hold the seat for the Democrats. I think it's important for lots of reasons, mostly because I think we're at an inflection point in our country that has a consequence that is almost hard to imagine in terms of the strength of our democracy.
Sure.
And I think the Democratic Party, with its flaws, is in a much better position to defend that.
Yeah. Okay, Dan Kildee, always great.
Good to see you.
We'll see you up here next year in your new role.
I'll be here. I'll probably have green hair and a really loud jacket.
That's right. Let it all hang out, right? All right. Thanks so much for
being
with us.
You bet.
We're going to continue our special coverage of the Mackinac Policy Conference live from the dining room of the Grand Hotel on Mackinac Island now with a conversation I had just a little earlier today with the governor of our state. Gretchen Whitmer has been governor since 2018, has two more years in that role, and is someone whose name comes up from time to time in the context of national politics. I talked to her about her plans for this week on Mackinac Island and her plans for the future. Governor Gretchen Whitmer, always great to see you. And of course, it's great to see you here on Mackinac Island.
Thank you, Stephen.
All right, so I ask everybody this off the rip. What is your goal? What's your agenda for being up here on the island? What do you hope to get done this week?
I think, you know, this conference always comes right at a time where we start negotiating budgets. Mm-hmm. And my focus is making sure
that... It's
not done yet. We've got a lot of legislative leaders up here making sure that we keep moving toward getting the budget completed, that it's got... it's a reflection of the values and the things that we need to get done as a state. And I think there are a lot of people here who have a big stake in that. And so harnessing all that energy to make sure we get it done on time and that it's another good budget that's balanced and bipartisan.
Yeah. A lot of people have scratched their heads a bit about the pace of the budget this year, given that, you know, Democrats have control of the governor's office and both houses of the legislature. What has been the holdup, in your opinion?
Well, we'll get it done by the end of June, and that is the statutory requirement.
That's when you're supposed
now.
To, right?
Yeah. I mean, it hasn't always been that way, Stephen. So right. I think that's.
I can remember some Septembers when we were still thinking about the budget.
And you know, I know everyone says, "Oh, Democrats control everything." We have a one-seat majority in each of the House and the Senate, and you know, obviously, it is always two branches negotiating with one another, regardless of who's in charge. It's always been the case. Harry Gast, decades ago, used to say, the governor proposes and the legislature disposes.
So
there's always a lot of negotiation that has to happen. And I think we're making headway, but we're in a strong position. I'm proud of the work that we've gotten done, the investments we've made. I want to see the lunch and breakfast covered for students going forward. I mean, these are big ticket items that are really important. And we just got to work through some of the other differences in the budget.
You know, one of the things that I've been saying about the budget that you proposed is that it represents a shift not just in sort of immediate spending, but I think in the way we think about spending and the way we frame government support for our civic infrastructure, really, the things that really matter to people's lives. I had a conversation with Monique Stanton, the Michigan Lead for Public Policy, and their analysis of some of the things that you're doing. Talk just a little bit about what you're up to there and how transformational you think it might be if we could do all of that.
Well, I do think that as we look at trying to grow our population and the Growing Together Council that we created last year, a lot of what's in this budget that I introduced is reflective of trying to make Michigan a place where Michiganders can get ahead and others come to for opportunity. Investing in our people, in our workforce. When you talk about that, you're obviously combining business needs with individual opportunity. That's where we find a real sweet spot. So when we make those investments, when I'm told, oh, you really are an education governor, everyone claims to be, but you've actually done so much stuff in this space to connect people to skills and level financial barriers so others can get the enhanced skill set to get in better paying jobs. I'm proud to hear that. I'm proud of the work we've done around public safety, and I think we've got a really important story to tell here in Michigan and elevating the quality of people's lives.
Yeah. So you believe it'll be done by June 30?
Absolutely.
We're going to hold you to that.
I'll knock on wood for that, too.
Right. Okay. Yesterday, up here on stage, Mayor Mike Duggan gave his address, and in it, he was pretty critical of the state and the way state government has handled mental health in Michigan, and he was describing the problems that Detroit police encounter, in part, he says, because of those shortcomings. How do you answer that?
Well, I agree. You know, we know that in the 90s, John Engler eviscerated our mental health system. I know the mayor yesterday pointed out Lafayette Clinic.
Yes.
What happened there? People being turned out in crisis. It was horrible. We know after the pandemic that there's a lot more comfort talking about mental health. We should have been doing this a long time ago, but I've just, with this new legislature, finally got a mental health parity bill to my desk. I got to sign it in the recent weeks, and I think that that represents a real commitment to addressing and making progress in terms of addressing the mental health crisis. Substance abuse addiction, we know that this and mental health often go hand in hand, and if you're treating one but not the other, you're not actually helping people resolve, you know, the issues that they're confronting. So
Sure. There's
a lot of work to do in this space. We've made huge investments in our schools to address mental health for our young people, but there's always more work to do in this space, and while we're making progress, we got to stay at it.
Are we failing the way the mayor described yesterday?
I think if you have the opportunity to talk with our clinicians, we know that there aren't enough of them. The ability to get mental health services online is a step in the right direction. And frankly, the pandemic gave us the opportunity to see how that might work and to expand on that. So encouraging people to go into this work, destigmatizing mental health, making access to care for substance abuse disorder, all of these are important pieces to it. Not one solves the problem. We got to do all of the above and more.
Yeah. So we are still in the midst, I guess, of a great windfall, I guess, of federal money that has come from a number of different bills that were passed in Congress. And I want to have you talk just a little about things that you think the average Michigander can look at or point to and say, well, this is better or this is different because of that money. A lot of people, I think, wonder about things like that. Is this really going to make a difference? What would you say they should be looking to?
I think naturally you hear people in Washington, D.C. talk about $3 trillion. You're like, what the heck does that mean? How is it making my life better? And and I get that. And I think that's part of the disconnect between what happens in D.C. and in everyone's lives. I can tell you, though, when I talk to someone who's got a job paying $85,000 a year in the Bay Area doing something around chips, right, that is improving the quality of their life, improving the quality of the community, making sure that we're uplifting people's lives. When we announced yesterday that we've got this aggressive $367 million to bring down the cost of energy for 28,000 families, that is a real way that we're helping people save money and address carbon, you know, that emissions. When we focus on housing, we're aggressively changed our goal yesterday by 53%. It's much more aggressive, 115,000 new or refurbished homes all across Michigan, affordable housing. This is how we get people who are unhoused housed. This is how we create opportunity for people who want to get one of the jobs that we've been able to announce over the last few years. So I think that these are the things. If you're saving money on your rent, or you're able to buy a home for the first time, or you've got a more energy-efficient appliance or solar on your roof, you're able to keep more money in your pocket and get ahead. And that's all because of the federal actions and because of the Biden-Harris administration.
Yeah. I want to talk about insurance reform, because a few weeks ago I was talking with someone about things that have happened up here on Mackinac in the past, things we've gotten done. The insurance reform really did come together up here more clearly than in other places. A lot of people don't think it's working. I don't know that I've had a conversation with you about whether and when we might go back and take another swipe at that.
Well, I know that there's conversation in the legislature. There has been ever since the first iteration,
yeah.
right, when we were up here on Mackinac. I think we've made progress. We've given consumers some choice. We've been able to bring down some costs for folks, and that was the primary motivation.
Not really, though, right?
Right.
I mean, most people paying
as
more.
Dramatically as we wanted to know, right? And so I do think that there's more work to happen in this space. We also have had a lawsuit and some clarity by virtue of a legal decision, and so I think that has helped make sure that people who can get the medically necessary care that they need, but I believe and recognize that there's more work to do here so that we can help more Michiganders get reasonable insurance coverage.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I've got you here. I got to ask about all the national attention that you get and the ambitions that maybe some people are assigning to you in a national perspective. I've never really asked you about that. What do you make of all of that?
You know, people are going to say whatever they're going to say. I don't really give it much credence. No one knows what's in my heart and my mind.
Well, you do.
I do. I'm going to give you the same answer I've given everyone. You know, I'm right where I want to be. I'm not going anywhere for the next 2.5 years. What happens beyond that? I don't know. I really think I might go walk the earth for a year and figure out what's next for me, because this has been a roller coaster of a job.
It always is for, you know, I mean, it whoever's
always is,
in it.
But Steve, no one has dealt with pandemics,
that's true,
recall attempts, plots, you know, dams being washed out.
It's been
out.
A little different stretch, right?
It's been a little more challenging than most. But, you know, I really don't know what's next. I'm not planning on any future runs. I'm really not. I wrote a book that, just to put a little light out in the world, 10 things I've learned in my life that'll maybe help give people a laugh or a little inspiration in what feels like a heavy, hard time.
I think a lot of people see that as a signal of national ambition as
well. Wait till you read it. It ain't that kind of book.
It's not that kind of book?
It's not a self-congratulatory memoir, which is what people write when they run for higher office.
Let me ask the question a different way. Among the things that you've had to do as governor here, which do you think would prepare you the most for a national elected office? What kinds of things that you've learned or experienced in this job would be applicable and powerful at the next level?
Well, I think, you know, when you look at Washington, D.C., I think it's important that we have people with executive experience. You know, we have a lot of people who go from the Senate to the presidency, and I remember sitting in Detroit when the Democrats had the presidential debate. There were like 17 of them. It was a two-night event because there were so many candidates.
It was a lot of fun, by the way.
It was. And the Fox Theater, which we showed out. It was fantastic. It was like the prequel to the NFL draft.
Right.
But it was kind of startling to see there were three governors on that stage, and they could not cut through.
Yeah.
Because governors got to get stuff done.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't mean stuff. Right? Governors got to get stuff done.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, we got to be able to negotiate and lead, and the buck stops with one person. And someone from our legislative body takes, you know, it's an important job, but they take positions on issues. They don't, at the end of the day, have to own.
Accountable for them, right?
Right, right. Yeah. And so I think that executive experience is something that's really important.
Yeah. Okay. Governor Gretchen Whitmer, always great to see you.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll have more special coverage from the Mackinac Policy Conference on Mackinac Island. We're back with more of WDET's live coverage of the Mackinac Policy Conference from the dining room of the Grand Hotel on Mackinac Island. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm joined now by two really important people in our community. Rip Rapson is the CEO of the Kresge Foundation. Rip, great to see you up here on the island.
Good morning, Stephen.
And Wendy Jackson is Kresge's Vice President for Detroit Programs. Did I get that title right?
No, but that's okay. I'll take it.
What is your official title?
It's Managing Director.
Managing Director for Detroit.
That's making my life very complicated.
That's right.
Good morning.
That's your role, not your job. It's great to have you here as well, Wendy. It's great to have you guys both here. This is an important year for Kresge.
It is your 100th anniversary. It's really hard to think about that, really, when I stop and look at the signs and see the things that you're doing for 100 years. Talk about how significant that is.
Well, the way you set it up, I think, is the right way to do it. Because if you just view this as just a party, some kind of capricious milestone in an organization's history, that's one thing. But if you actually take the time to go back and say, where did this thing start? Why did it start?
Right.
What were its first principles? Did it live to those principles over the years? How did it change? Did it adapt to changing times? Where does it sit now? Does that mean it's going to sit the same way in the next 20 years? And so what we're trying to do in the centennial is sort of ask some of those questions. You know, where was Kresge during the lunch counter demonstrations when five and dimes were an important factor? Where was Kresge when nonprofit capitalization became an issue in the 50s and the 60s and it played a significant role? Where was it during the civil rights movement? Where has it been during the bankruptcy? Where is it going to be going forward? So we're trying to make this truly a celebration of an institution that should be proud of its legacy, but an institution that really needs to be reflective about the role of philanthropy, what's that meant to Detroit, what might that mean not only to Detroit, but other cities we work in over the next many years. And so I think we're going to take that opportunity, have a lot of conversation.
How much has changed since 100 years ago when the foundation started?
Well, it really began in sort of classic early 20th century pocketbook philanthropy style. You had a wealthy corporate actor who wanted to do good and just gave money to the causes he cared about.
Yeah.
And that grew over the years as Kresge grew and as Kmart grew. And it evolved into an approach that tried to underwrite the capital campaigns of nonprofits. That could be a college dormitory, it could be a hospital, it could be an arts organization. And then about 20 years ago, we decided that we had really made our mark as much as we could in that space and pivoted to trying to focus much more on cities and what it meant to build opportunity structures in cities across America, and particularly in our hometown of Detroit.
Yeah. Wendy, you lead the Detroit programming for Kresge. Talk about the things that Detroiters would recognize in their lives that Kresge is doing. It's a long list. We won't get to all of it.
It is a long list.
But just give us some examples.
Yeah. So Detroit is really Kresge's signature place-based program and really the flagship. We've been able to remain the constant for 100 years, and the next 100 years will definitely be determined by what we do in our hometown. But there's so much that the community recognizes, from Campus Martius and Eastern Market and some of the, you know, really iconic assets that we have in the city and that support the city and the region, but also increasingly our work in neighborhoods, whether it is beautifying pocket parks in neighborhoods across the city. You know, our work obviously at the Mary Grove campus has been a major project for us. A lot of our arts and culture work has really, I think, been a signature part of our efforts in Detroit, both celebrating individual artists, but also, you know, just iconic arts and culture projects.
Absolutely.
All across the city. So it is a long list,
yeah.
And we're looking forward to reminding folks of that.
Yeah, right. Talk about the decision-making process, though, for figuring out where you want to have an impact in Detroit and what you're trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. So our work in Detroit is both citywide and neighborhood-based.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very fortunate to work with a team of about 15 who we try and balance kind of the strategic nature of what we do. So identifying opportunities within the team to invest in and be a part of. But we also balance that with requests that just come in from Detroiters who are, you know, doing great work in their community. And so we really try and balance those two things. The decision-making process is daily. But it's interesting you ask that question, because most folks don't know kind of the inside baseball approach of, you know, how do we make decisions? What's the information that we use to make decisions? Mm-hmm. How residents inform so much of what we do and decide where to be strategic at?
Yeah.
You know, I was going to just add, Stephen, that one of the characteristics of philanthropy sort of seen in its a negative light is that they get in their mind a series of things they want to invest in and they just stick to it.
Yeah.
And I think particularly given the city we live in, that's just not possible. Mm-hmm. You can't predict an economic collapse. You can't predict political dysfunction. You can't predict bankruptcies. Can't predict COVID. And so one of the characteristics, I think, of Kresge has been its adaptability, that we balance exactly as Wendy has suggested, things that seem to need long-term tending, mm-hmm. whether it's a regional transportation system or a P20 campus at Mary Grove, or whether it's the kind of thing that just can't wait, that you just simply have to attend to the public health system when it breaks down during a COVID crisis, or when small businesses are in dire straits and you just simply can't wait around figuring out how to be strategic about your support for small business. You just have to move. And I do think that that's a quality that sometimes is lost on people, is that we can be very adaptive if we need to. And that's an enormous community resource, because often neither the public sector nor the private sector can move that quickly.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, the things that have happened in Detroit over the last just 15 years are kind of unimaginable on a city scale, right? There is not another city that's endured all the crazy. and I think that's had an effect on all of us, but it's also affected philanthropy in the sense that you're asked to do things that philanthropy wouldn't necessarily be asked to do in other cities, and you're a stopgap in many ways to stop the worst things from happening and having the consequences that they could.
And I think some people are bothered by that a little bit. We've heard the criticism.
It's a lot of power.
Yeah, we've got no election certificate. Right, we don't report back to our shareholders. You know, what's our accountability? And that's completely legitimate. But I also think that most of the problems that Detroit faces, that any major urban area faces, require that all of these sectors sort of figure out their roles. And sometimes you got to cross boundaries. I mean, sometimes it's just not something the public sector can do. Woodward Corridor was not something the private sector was prepared to invest in 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. It needed investment. Neighborhoods have long been disinvested and marginalized. So I think, again, this sort of notion of shape-shifting, that sometimes we look a little bit like private investors, sometimes we look like sort of more public process, mm-hmm. sometimes we look like classic nonprofits.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, through it all, you know, our role has been to look at opportunities where we can continue to help propel Detroit forward. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we may not always get it right, but the idea is, because we have such flexible capital, it is a responsibility, and there is a public charge to what we do. And so making sure that where we invest continues to move the city forward and catalyze, you know, things that, as Rip said, the public sector might not be able to do right now, or the private sector might not be able to do. So that's where we have this unique leadership role.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, it's, you know, as many say, it's a three-legged stool. So we have to work in concert very often to really get the job done.
And it's about staying connected to residents, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that
mm-hmm.
part, you have to get that right.
100%. And that's been, I think, one of the important changes in philanthropy across the board in our city, is just more of a focus on resident voice, making sure residents are more at the decision-making tables.
Sure.
When at least our roles and our resources are being brought to bear. And, you know, Detroit is just really blessed to have so many philanthropies working in concert, but that whole piece around making sure that we're deeply connected to residents and resident priorities has been, I think, one of the first principles.
Yeah.
It sometimes makes for interesting tension zones. I can't tell you how many times I've gotten calls from elected officials saying, that's your grantee. Why is that organization making such trouble for us? Mm-hmm. Don't you understand?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I've said, well, it's a different form of pluralism, right? That we sometimes are a vehicle through which the community's voice can be heard in a different way. And that can be annoying to a public sector official or a private sector official. But I think, again, it's a long-term balancing act where you don't overstep any of those roles, but you try to keep them in balance.
Okay, Rip Rapson, CEO of the Kresge Foundation, and Wendy Jackson, Managing Director for the Detroit Program and the Kresge Foundation. Great to have both of you here. On Mackinac Island, settle a dispute for me, please. The producers of this show have this answer wrong, so I'm hoping you get it right. Fudge or taffy?
Oh, are you kidding? Who could get that one wrong?
Well, what do you think is the right answer?
Well, it is fudge, of course.
Oh, no!
Yeah, fudge!
Not you!
My goodness. I can't believe you would even ask that question.
I'm so outnumbered on this, too. Everyone I ask, other than the mayor. The mayor was on my side.
Taffy is just like bubble gum with sugar.
Well, what is fudge? It's just all
chocolate with sugar.
All right. Well, I will stand by my allegiance to taffy, even though most people disagree. But thank you guys both.
Thank you. Appreciate you, Stephen.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
That's going to do it for this hour of our live coverage from Mackinac Island. We'll be back at 11 o'clock. Nick Austin will have interviews as well. On Point is up next. Big thanks to our sponsor, Optic Birmingham, for making this year's coverage possible. An optical boutique where you can find original, never-worn, vintage, and exclusive contemporary eyewear. More info at opticbirmingham.com. Thanks for joining us here on Mackinac Island. I will be back in Detroit next week.